But the hardened sight, if it was substituted for narrows, would have to be authorized all over again. At its authorization hearings, it would run into cost-conscious members of Congress and the environmental movement, which hadn't existed when narrows was first authorized. Worse still, far worse, was the fact that it would have to be justified with a discount or interest rate twice as high. Since narrows was the cheaper site, and it could barely pass muster at a 3.25% discount rate, it was hard to see how a hardened dam could ever be authorized. Now that the hardened site had reemerged as an alternative, however, it could only be viewed as a threat. The Bureau of Reclamation, therefore, decided that there was only one course open to it. It had to break ground on the Narrows project quickly, and the first step was to move the people out of the way. The history of relocation, removing people in the way of a project from their land and compensating them for what they lost, started early in the century with the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was embellished a short while later by the New York City Water Department when it drowned the Catskill Valleys to create a new water supply. These were the first times in our history, except, of course, for the indignities visited on the Indians, when thousands of people were dispossessed for the crime of impeding progress. What the TVA did in the 1930s, what the Corps of Engineers did along the Missouri in the later 1940s, and what the Bureau tried to do in the Weldon Valley in the 1970s followed the same script. They sniffed through the community, smelling out its most avaricious members, those most susceptible to an offer. They spread rumors. They spread lies. They offered extravagant settlements to the first few who bit, then grew less and less spendthrift with the holdouts, both to punish them and to balance the initial extravagance. They played on the social conscience of communities, accusing them of selfishness, of denying the greatest good to the greatest numbers. And in the final resort, judiciously at first, then more threateningly, then like a defensive line blitzing a quarterback, they invoked the prospect of eminent domain. They did all this without a sense of shame, because they told themselves they were serving an ultimate good. They were preventing floods, feeding the hungry world, offering power and light to schools and heat and air conditioning to hospitals. They denied, to themselves as to their would-be victims, that the real reason they were doing it was that they couldn't bear the thought of no longer building dams. And the very majesty of their great works made it easier for them to do it. It may be easier to sweep hundreds of people out of the way than 10 or 12, as if a project important enough to call for the removal of so many must be worth building. George Kinsel, an employee of the Colorado Department of Social Services, who witnessed firsthand the trauma the Bureau's relocation effort was causing in the Weldon Valley, was always struck by its indifference to its victims' fate. "They were like Jekyll and Hyde," Kinsel says. "When you met them on the street or in meetings or the coffee shop in Fort Morgan, they'd smile and joke with the same people they were trying to throw off their land. They were in here for so long, they almost felt like members of the local community. You had to keep reminding yourself of the real reason they were here." When the Bureau's men approached Ben Schatz, a South Dakota farmer whose land it wanted for the Owyhee Diversion Project, they said, "To us, you're just a dot on the map. When you get in the way, we move you." When you get in the way, we move you. Don Christensen was sitting at home one day in 1976 when the phone rang. Don's wife, Karen, picked it up. It was a neighbor, someone the Christensens did not see regularly. Don could see from Karen's expression that it was something bad. Karen kept saying, "No, no, no. No, it's ridiculous. It's crazy." When she hung up, she looked at Don with a pained expression, half laughing, half anguished. "The talk they hear is that we've sold out." Don and Karen Christensen cannot prove that it was the Bureau that spread the rumor. Could it have been Felix Sparks? Harris Sherman? "The frustrating thing was we didn't know where the rumor came from," said Karen. "It was so evil, so nasty a thing to do. You feel so helpless, but you feel so mad. When I heard that rumor, I just wanted to scream." It might have been the Lower South Platte Conservancy District. The district was not above some rather sneaky tactics. in the full-color brochure was still using in 1981 as a propaganda piece for Narrows, it showed Bijou Creek coming in behind the dam, not in front of it, even though that plan had been dead since 1965. Called on this point, Gary Freehoff, its young executive director, offered what seemed like a lame explanation. "We're still going through the old stock of brochures." It was not the first rumor, and by no means would it be the last. At the Dam Fighters Conference in Washington, Christensen had been warned by someone who had watched the Corps of Engineers in action in the Middle West that divisive rumors spread innocuously in neighboring towns would be a prime tactic when the Bureau began trying to buy the land in the reservoir area. Not long afterward, Don got a call from a neighbor who had just gone to Fort Morgan to get a haircut. The man in the next chair had been talking about all the people who, according to scuttlebutt he had heard, were thinking of selling out early. He represented himself as a real estate broker from out of town. No one had ever seen him before. The Bureau knew exactly whom to go after. Sandy Desmond, a pseudonym, was for a time one of the leaders of the regional landowners group. Everyone liked Sandy. He was amiable, a teddy bear, a sort of irrepressibly cheerful Mr. Micawber. His weakness was also Micawber's. Sandy loved money, and he liked to make a fast buck. Nonetheless, people didn't really worry too much about Sandy. He was, after all, a leader of the opposition. To hear him rave against the Bureau was almost an embarrassment. Small children had to be kept out of earshot. "We're going to kick their goddamn butts out of here in 6 months," he said in 1975, after the Bureau set up its first project office since the 1940s. One Weldon Valley resident remembers how she found out about Sandy. "My husband walked in the house one day," she says. "I think it was late in the afternoon. I was sitting right here at the kitchen table. I could tell from the look on my husband's face that something was really wrong. All the things that it could be flashed through my mind in a second, and I just lighted on Sandy. I said, 'Sandy went over.' And he said, 'Yep, Sandy went over.' They made him an offer he couldn't refuse." "They poisoned the atmosphere in this community, something dreadful," said the woman. "They went after the people they thought were more likely to sell, but they also spread lies about the leaders of the regional landowners' organization. We just heard the rumors. We didn't know who was spreading them. We didn't know if they were true. When I heard that rumor about Don Christensen selling out, I thought, well, that's the end. They created such an atmosphere of distrust, it took years before we got over it. I'm not sure we have completely yet." Another weapon in the Narrows lobby repertoire was the old strategy of feint and dodge. "Every time we read one of their new reports, the figures were different," says Don Christensen. "In one document, they said they were going to have 100,000 acre-feet available from the reservoir each year. They said 120,000 acre-feet. At one point, they were up to 150,000. They never gave an explanation. They just changed the numbers on us all the time, so we had to get out the old calculator and prove them wrong again. All the while, I'm trying to raise 1,000 acres of corn and worry about a few hundred head of cattle. It was no picnic, I'll tell you. One thing about the Bureau, though," Christensen added grimly, "they sure know how to make a person mad." Meanwhile, as the Bureau was doing battle with the Weldon Valley on the one hand, or Poverty Valley, as Gary Freehoff of the Lower South Platte Organization described it to me, and with the newly elected Carter administration on the other, one of Carter's first actions was to put Narrows on his initial water project's hit list, the state engineer, C.J. Kuiper, thought he had discovered yet another fatal flaw in the scheme. It was one of those details that dwell in a special kind of obscurity reserved for the perfectly obvious. What if the water couldn't possibly get to where it was intended to go? "At first I never thought much about the channel losses," the state engineer would remember later on, "but one of the biggest headaches of my job had always been getting water down to the senior irrigators along the South Platte. All the groundwater pumpers who came along during the 50s and 60s and 70s had been depauperizing the aquifer on both sides of the river. Some guy would call on 52nd feet that were his rights, and my river master would cut off the junior diverters and the pumpers upstream so he could get it. Nothing would arrive. He'd call in another 50 cubic feet per second, and we'd send it to him, and it still wouldn't arrive. I said to myself, what the hell's going on here? Then we figured out that it was all being captured by the aquifers. The pumpers had emptied those aquifers so bad that they were acting like pumps. The water we sent down went right through the bottom of the plant and migrated laterally and went into the aquifer. It was like it had a great big hole in it. So I went to the Bureau and I told them their water was going to disappear on the way down from Narrows to the South Platte Conservancy District, and they said, hogwash. I said, hogwash? We're cutting junior diverters up and down the river by 400 cubic feet per second so the seniors at Julesburg can get 20 cubic feet per second, and they're still not getting a goddamn drop. The Bureau was saying that if they released 100,000 acre-feet out of Narrows Reservoir, maybe 90,000 acre-feet would arrive at the headgates of the guys they'd contracted to sell the water to. Well, they were full of baloney. They'd be lucky to get 25,000 acre-feet. I kept telling the Bureau and Felix Sparks and Harris that I didn't care if they built their dam or not, Kuiper said, but I'm the one who has to see to it that every irrigator gets the water he's entitled to. Well, if the Bureau promises them 90,000 acre-feet and I can only deliver 20,000, I'm the one who gets blamed. I can't give them 90,000 unless I cut off others who have senior rights, and that's illegal. The Bureau was making a bunch of outlandish promises, and I was the one who was supposed to keep them. The Bureau, Dick Lamb, Felix Sparks, and Harris Sherman naturally refused to believe a word Kuiper said. Even so, his reputation was good enough, and his statements were colorful enough that the newspapers listened to him. And soon the issue of channel losses, of the Bureau planning to build a $226 million project that might not be able to deliver water, was all over the local press. Sensing yet another impasse, the Bureau decided that it had better get someone else's opinion. Someone else turned out to be Woodward Clyde. A huge engineering firm of considerable reputation, Woodward Clyde has enjoyed a comfortable relationship of long standing with the Bureau. The Bureau often relies on Woodward Clyde to perform independent assessments of its plans, then it often rewards it with lucrative construction contracts. It was no surprise, therefore, when Woodward Clyde's estimate of channel losses in the Platte coincided nicely with the Bureau's. Kuiper, however, continued to insist that both of them were wrong. Their whole calculation was based on average annual channel losses, he said. Well, they may be right on an annualized basis, but an annualized basis doesn't mean a damn thing. Most of those channel losses occur in the summertime, when the Platte Valley Aquifer has been pumped out. That's when it acts like it has a hole in it and the water going down the river just disappears into it. But summertime is when the Narrows customers are going to need their water. That's the irrigation season. They're going to call on it and it won't get there. The Woodward Clyde study was interesting in other respects, for it went on to examine the other questions that were being raised about the Narrows. It concluded that a safe dam can be built at the Narrow site, but as Kuiper pointedly noted, declined to say at what cost. In stark contrast to the conclusions of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, it said that the project would have no adverse effect on sandhill cranes. And even though 50 miles away, the Badger and Beaver irrigation districts were pioneering an alternative to on-stream and off-stream reservoirs, groundwater storage, it concluded that groundwater storage was not an economically feasible alternative to the Narrows. Nothing was more striking, however, than its conclusion that the Bureau's claimed benefits for recreation remain valid, even though primary production biomass in the reservoir will exceed levels that are usually indicative of eutrophy. In that remarkable juxtaposition of irreconcilable conclusions, Woodward Clyde was tacitly agreeing with the Environmental Protection Agency, which was convinced that Narrows Reservoir, touted by the Bureau as a fine new recreational lake, would quickly turn into a fetid, grossly polluted agricultural sump. Between the partially treated sewage of nearly 2 million people, the untreated runoff of hundreds of thousands of cows, some of them defecating right in the river, and pesticides and fertilizers washing in from thousands and thousands of acres of intensely farmed land, between this and the fact that the reservoir would be shallow and warm, with an evaporation rate of 4 feet a year, the water quality was going to be absolutely awful. The EPA was suggesting that it would not be for contact, which meant no swimming or water skiing without a waterproof covering over every inch of one's body. Woodward Clyde seemed to agree. It said biomass would exceed the levels that produce eutrophication, which is when a body of water begins turning into an algae pool. But it also agreed, implicitly if not explicitly, with the Bureau and Dick Lamb when they said that this aspiring swamp was destined to become the most popular reservoir in the entire state. If one believed the brochure of the Lower South Platte Conservancy District, as many people would be drawn to fetid, shallow, bath-warm Lake Narrows as are drawn to Yellowstone National Park. Here was a dam that the state engineer said would deliver only a third of the water it promised and could conceivably collapse, a project whose official cost estimate, if what two officials of the Union Pacific had privately suggested was correct, would barely suffice to relocate 26 miles of railroad track, a project whose real cost, whatever it turned out to be, would therefore be written off in substantial measure to recreation, though the water would be unsafe to touch, a project whose prevailing interest rate, crucial to justifying the whole scheme, was one-fifth the rates banks were charging in the late 1970s, a project many of whose beneficiaries owned more land than the law permitted in order to receive subsidized water, even after the acreage limit was stretched to 960 acres in 1982, a project that might, if the state engineer was correct, seep enough water to turn the town of Fort Morgan into a marsh, a project that would pile more debt onto the Bureau's Missouri Basin account, a project that would generate not a single kilowatt of hydroelectric power and would be all but worthless for flood control. And yet, on top of all this, there was still to be another development, one that ought to have finished off the Narrows project once and for all. Most of the farmers, who were supposed to be the beneficiaries, said they didn't want the water. The farmers, it turned out, were not as ingenuous as the Bureau wished them to be. During the years it had pushed for the Narrows project, the Bureau had never quoted them a firm price for the water, nor guaranteed them a fixed amount. Why, in that case, should they obligate themselves to buy it for the next 40 years? In a letter to the Denver Post, Jacob Corman, the president of the Irrigationist Association Water District No. 1, the pre-existing water district over which the Lower South Platte Conservancy District was trying to impose itself as a superagency, explained the farmer's position. There are 15 irrigation districts in our association from Kersey near Greeley to Balzac below Brush, Corman wrote. If built, the dam would be in the heart of our district. These ditch companies provide irrigation water to 125,000 acres of land. 12 of these ditch companies, representing farmers irrigating 105,350 acres, have taken positions opposing the Narrows. One, representing 1,100 acres, has indicated support. At the last report, two, involving 19,100 acres, have taken no position. Although many of the ditch companies in his district were initially enthusiastic about the project, Corman said, those which have been offered specific contracts by the Lower South Platte Conservation District have found these contracts to be unacceptable. The main reason was that the contracts demanded that the farmers pay for water released at the dam. The Bureau refused to guarantee delivery of the water at the farmers' headgates, as if to demonstrate that it knew all along that Kuiper's theory about channel losses was correct. The farmers might be a trusting lot, but they weren't dumb. The office of our state engineer, Corman concluded, is the only office which has both the data and the technical staff to make a professional assessment as to what the real impact of the Narrows would be on providing water for irrigated agriculture in northeastern Colorado. Actually, most of the ditch companies in the association feel that the unadjudicated water which we need to supplement our reservoirs and decreed waters would in all probability be lost if Narrows were built. That a majority of the farmers, for whose benefit Narrows was to be constructed, finally decided they would lose more water than they would gain from the dam was fascinating. The unadjudicated water of which Corman spoke were those high flows which, after every Colorado farmer had taken his water right and Nebraska had been guaranteed its share, the farmers could skim off for themselves. As of now, no one owned these occasional surpluses in the river. Anyone could divert them for storage in off-stream reservoirs or in the aquifer beneath his farm. But with Narrow's Dam in place, all but the most extraordinary high flows, the 50-year floods, would be captured and they would belong to the Bureau of Reclamation. The Bureau would charge money for them, charge even if it refused to guarantee that the water would ever arrive. The Bureau wasn't even offering the farmers a pig and a poke. It was offering them a poke without a pig. In 1982, at the behest of Senator Gary Hart, Woodward Clyde did yet another study of the Narrows problem. It was now a problem, as often as it was a project, and reversed its earlier conclusions as innocently as if they had never been held. Its estimate of water available for annual delivery was now down from more than 80,000 acre-feet to 34,000 acre-feet, almost in line with Kuiper's estimate and fathoms below the Bureau's. The effects on the sandhill and whooping cranes and other migratory wildlife downstream were now regarded as moderately negative instead of insignificant. But the most startling reversal came when the firm recalculated the worthiness of the project in simple economic terms. Using an interest rate of 7.5%, but retaining the doubtful flood control benefit of $800,000 a year and a highly optimistic view of the recreational potential, Woodward Clyde came up with a benefit-cost ratio of only 0.10 to 1. For every dollar invested, 10 cents would be returned. Even with an interest rate of 3.25%, Narrows was a loser. Like most water projects, though, Narrows refused to roll over and die. In 1983, Congress, at the urging of local Representative Hank Brown, voted it another $475,000 appropriation. It wasn't enough to build anything, but it was enough to keep it alive. The latest unofficial cost estimates, in 1984, were in the neighborhood of $500 million. If they are correct, each acre-foot, assuming 34,000 acre-feet is the annual yield, will cost $14,500 to develop. Few Colorado farmers can afford to pay more than $50 an acre-foot for water, and the Bureau has never charged any of its client farmers half that much. Most get it for $7.50 or less. The taxpayers, presumably, will make up the difference, buying a couple of hundred farmers about the most expensive water on earth. And yet, in early 1984, the politicians who had always been for the Narrows were still for it. Senator Gary Hart, a neoliberal, was for it. Liberal Congressman Tim Wirth was not against it. Senator Bill Armstrong, a budget-conscious conservative Republican, supported it. But no one was for it as much as Dick Lamb, although Dick Lamb was the one politician honest enough to admit, discreetly, that it wasn't worth building. Once, at a Denver Broncos football game, Karen Christensen's sister and her husband found themselves sitting a few seats away from the governor, sporting their big, bright Stop the Narrows buttons. Lamb noticed the buttons, came over, and asked who they were. Then, in an odd small burst of candor, the intense, young, forward-thinking governor delivered himself of a private opinion about the project he had championed so relentlessly. "I know Narrows isn't the best project in the world. I'd much rather use the money to build up the state's economy in a more efficient way. But when Washington offers you that kind of economic impetus, a governor can't just turn it down." Repeating the story, Don Christensen mused, "If that's the way they run a railroad, then this country hasn't got any hope." Meanwhile, in Denver, Clarence Kuiper had taken early retirement. "The Narrows thing got so annoying to me, I couldn't stand it, so I retired," Kuiper says. "I've lived too long to put up with that sort of nonsense." Early in 1984, he was no less convinced than ever that Narrows, if built, stood a respectable chance of collapsing like Teton, an issue that had become all but lost in the minutiae of the debate. "Unless they extend that grout curtain a hell of a lot farther than they plan to, they're going to get seepage, just like they did at Teton. Seepage is one of the worst things that can happen to an earth-filled dam. I'd rather have water going over the top in a waterfall than chewing away at my abutments. That's still the number one issue as far as I'm concerned." Neither the Lamb administration nor the Bureau was ready to listen to Kuiper. Lamb, however, had finally found a way to get even. the firm with which Kuiper now serves as a consultant, the Harza Engineering Company of Chicago, was the other contender, with Woodward Clyde, for the lucrative South Platte Basin Alternative Study in 1982. Because of Kuiper's relationship with Harza, it didn't get it. Suave Bill McDonald, who relieved the intemperate Felix Sparks of his command of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, put it right into his letter. Unless Harza dumped Kaiser as a consultant, it stood no chance of getting the contract. As far as Kuiper is concerned, he is being blackballed throughout the state. "They've stolen a man's livelihood," he says. "My pension isn't enough to live on. I know the state as well as anyone, but they've made my name mud." If one were to put an epitaph on this story, one might do no better than to quote Glenn Saunders, the man who championed water development for 50 years in Colorado and then, in the end, came up against a project he wanted to kill and couldn't. As he readily admits, it changed his whole way of looking at things. To Glenn Saunders, Narrows Dam was not so much a dam as a symbol of a senescent society seeking refuge in the past. "What that dam represents," he said, "is, first of all, the fact that there are very few honest people in the world. 98% of humanity cannot admit when it's made a mistake. This applies especially to politicians. A politician, for some reason, thinks it is political suicide to admit that he was wrong. Dick Lamb cannot bring himself to admit that he has been in error about Narrows. He has one of the finest minds in Colorado. His thinking on some subjects is some of the best thinking any politician in this age is capable of, but he cannot bring himself to say, 'I was wrong on the Narrows Dam.'" "The Bureau is the same way," Saunders went on. "It cannot admit when it has made a mistake. It has also run out of good projects, and on top of that, it has all of these bizarre cash register funds, the Missouri Basin Fund, which is behind the Narrows, that are supposed to make these projects self-financing. They do not, but no one understands that. The Bureau is like one of these crooks with money earning interest in 20 different banks. It has to spend the money on something. It is all borrowed money. It belongs to the people of the United States, but the people of the United States don't know that. The whole thing is a machine, a perpetual motion machine that keeps churning out dams, which the politicians and most Westerners are reflexively in favor of, and the whole business is running the country into the ground. The people who support these boondoggle projects are always talking about the vision and principles that made this country great. 'Our forefathers would have built these projects,' they say. 'They had vision.' That's pure nonsense. It wasn't the vision and principles of our forefathers that made this country great. It was the huge, unused bonanza they found here. One wave of immigrants after another could occupy new land, new land, new land. There was topsoil, water. There was gold, silver, and iron ore lying right on top of the earth. We picked our way through a ripe orchard and made it bare. The new generations are going to go down, down, down. With projects like the Narrows, we're trying to pretend that things are as they always were. Let's just go out and find some money and build a dam, and we'll all be richer and better off. We've been so busy spending money and reaping the fruits that we're blind to the fact that there are no more fruits. By trying to make things better, we're making them worse and worse." Chapter 12. Things Fall Apart. On a hydrographic map, the outline of the Ogallala Aquifer resembles the South American and African continents, broad and bulbous to the north, tapering to a narrow cape at the southern end. Driving its entire length, from southern South Dakota down into the heart of West Texas, where it feathers out just above the Pecos River, takes 2 long days and feels almost like a transcontinental trip, the more so because the landscape is relentlessly the same. The same flatness, the same treelessness, the same curveless 30-mile stretches of road. All that changes is the crops, sorghum, then corn, then sorghum, then corn, then alfalfa, wheat, cotton. Enough cotton, one would think, to clothe all humanity. This was the country that Coronado traversed, looking for the gold cities of Cibola. It is the country that cost him half his men, his reputation, and nearly his life. In Coronado's time, it grew nothing but short grass, on which millions of buffalo feasted. Feasting on them were grizzly bears, prairie wolves, vultures, and an unknown number of Sioux, Comanche, and Cheyenne. The tribes, widely regarded as ferocious, merely reflected the landscape itself. Even the Indians used the open plains mainly for seasonal hunting, retreating to river valleys when the weather became extreme, which was a good part of the time. The southern high plains, from Colorado south to the hill country of Texas, never knew a permanent civilization, as far as archaeologists can tell. There was a Llano culture as early as 10,000 BC, followed by others that came and went like snow. Around 1300 BC, Pueblo Indians occupied the region, but abandoned it less than a century later. The Comanche, superb horsemen, may have shunned the open plains as much as possible because there was no tree where one could tie up one's mount. A place where one couldn't even secure a horse was no place to try to anchor a civilization. White men were to learn that lesson repeatedly after the buffalo and the Indians were vanquished and gone. During the 1860s and 1870s, the plains hosted great cattle drives from Texas to Kansas, but those ended in drought, overgrazing, and falling meat prices. Depauperized of much of its grass and invaded by mesquite and weeds, the region emptied out. But a decade of wet weather and demand for bread during and after the First World War sparked a repopulation, and the plains became a sea of wheat. Then came the Dust Bowl. After each calamity, a residual population managed to remain, surviving on a few cattle, some defiant wheat, the government, and finally, oil and natural gas. It was one of those survivors who sank a water well, hooked up a new invention, a diesel-driven centrifugal pump, and discovered the region's bounteous secret. Underneath it, confined in a closed basin aquifer, was enough fresh water to fill Lake Huron. Everyone had always known there was water below. If you sank a well and erected a windmill-driven pump, you got enough for a family and a few head of stock. But windmills could bring up only a few gallons a minute and offered no clue as to how much water was actually down there. The centrifugal pump, which could raise 800 gallons a minute or more, did, and when geologists took a closer look, they confirmed the evidence offered by the pumps. Under the plains was the trapped runoff of several ice ages, all nicely confined within gravel beds. The thickness of the aquifer varied. Along the periphery it feathered to a few feet, but in the middle portions under Nebraska there were saturations of 700 feet. All in all, there were probably 3 billion acre-feet in confinement. A flow of 800 gallons a minute will fill an Olympic swimming pool in just over an hour. It will also conveniently irrigate 100 or more acres of crops. 100 acres of irrigated land on the plains is worth 500 acres unirrigated. Actually, it is worth more, because a farmer need never again worry about going bankrupt during a drought. The water was free. All you needed in order to make money, real money, to watch your net income rise from $8,000 to $40,000 a year, was cheap fossil fuel or electricity, a big mobile sprinkler, and pumps. The irrigation of the Ogallala region, which has occurred almost entirely since the Second World War, is, from a satellite's point of view, one of the most profound changes visited by man on North America. Only urbanization, deforestation, and the damming of rivers surpass it. In the space of 20 years, the high plains turned from brown to green, as if a tropical rain belt had suddenly installed itself between the Rockies and the 100th meridian. From an aeroplane, much of semi-arid West Texas now appears as lush as Virginia. Where one saw virtually nothing out the window 40 years ago, one now sees thousands and thousands of green circles. From 38,000 feet, each appears to be about the size of a nickel, though it is actually 133 acres, a dozen and a half baseball fields. The circles are created by self-propelled sprinklers referred to by some as wheels of fortune. A quarter-mile-long pipeline with high-pressure nozzles mounted on giant wheels which allow the whole apparatus to pass easily over a field of corn, a wheel of fortune is man-made rain. The machines even climb modest slopes, which would ordinarily defeat a ditch irrigation system. Wheels of fortune are super efficient, but intolerant. They don't like trees, shrubs, or bogs. Therefore, the millions and millions of shelter belt trees planted by the Civilian Conservation Corps have come down as fast as the region's fortunes have risen. All that now holds the soil in place is crops and water, which cannot last. In 1914, there were 139 irrigation wells in all of West Texas. In 1937, there were 1,166. In 1954, there were 27,983. In 1971, there were 66,144. Nebraska irrigated fewer than 1 million acres in 1959. In 1977, it irrigated nearly 7 million acres. The difference was almost entirely pumping from the Ogallala. By that year, there were, depending on whose estimates one believed, somewhere around 12 million acres irrigated by the Ogallala Aquifer. One of the poorest farming regions in the United States had metamorphosed overnight into one of the wealthiest, raising 40% of the fresh beef cattle in America and growing a huge chunk of our agricultural exports. As West Texas sprouted corn, a water-demanding crop that had never been known there, Lubbock and Amarillo sprouted skyscrapers, most of them erected by the banks that ecstatically financed the farmers' road to wealth. On Fridays, the farmers cruise into town from 80 miles away, behind the wheels of their Cadillacs and big Buick Electras. After a conference with a deferential banker, they go off for drinks and a dinner of steak and lobster, then to watch a Texas Tech football game from fieldside seats. Since 1950, Lubbock's population has increased at about the same rate as Texas's irrigated land, 7.5% a year. Anything growing at that rate doubles in size in a decade. There is, however, a second set of statistics which offers a more meaningful depiction of what is going on. By 1975, Texas was withdrawing some 11 billion gallons of groundwater per day. In Kansas, the figure was 5 billion, in Nebraska, 5.9 billion, in Colorado, 2.7 billion, in Oklahoma, 1.4 billion, in New Mexico, 1.6 billion. In places, farmers were withdrawing 4 to 6 feet of water a year, while nature was putting back half an inch. The overdraft from the Ogallala region in 1975 was about 14 million acre-feet a year, the flow of the Colorado River. It represented half the groundwater overdraft in the entire United States. The Colorado is not a big river, but it would be big enough to empty Lake Huron in a reasonably short time. The Ogallala region supports not so much a farming industry as a mining industry. If the pumping has been reckless, as some believe, it is an example of carefully planned recklessness, for all the states regulate the pumping of groundwater. Their choice was to allow its exhaustion within roughly 30 to 100 years after the pumping began in earnest back in the early 1960s. Except for petroleum and natural gas and coal, most mining industries affect a rather small area. This is one that affects an area larger than California. Actually, it affects the entire world, for the product of mining the Ogallala is a prodigious amount of food, much of it consumed overseas. It is a dead certainty that the Ogallala will begin to give out relatively soon. The only question is when. Everything hinges on one constant, the weight of water, and two variables, the cost of energy and the price of food. As anyone knows who has ever carried a full pail up 5 flights of steps, water is one of the heaviest substances on earth. Pumping it 100 or 200 feet out of the ground consumes a lot of energy. The Ogallala farmers do not benefit, as do many groundwater pumpers throughout the West, from hydroelectricity generated at Bureau of Reclamation dams and sold to them at discount rates. For the water table to drop 15 or 20 feet during a period when the price of energy increases sevenfold is a catastrophe. This, however, is precisely what happened throughout much of Kansas, Oklahoma, and West Texas between 1972 and 1984. During the same period, the price of most farm commodities barely doubled, if that. The odds are high, therefore, that long before all the water runs out, the farmers will no longer be able to afford to pump. In 1969, a study performed by Texas A&M University projected that the West Texas aquifer would decline to 44 million acre-feet by the year 2015, down from 341 million acre-feet before the Second World War. Irrigated acreage would by then have fallen to 125,000 acres from a mid-60s peak of 3.5 million acres. Sorghum yields would be down 90%, cotton would be down 65%, total agricultural value in the region would diminish by 80%. In those figures lay the makings of a Dust Bowl-size exodus, a social calamity, and a huge rash of bankruptcies that could ripple through the nation's economy. In 2015, the study predicted, there would be 300,000 fewer people in the region than there were in 1969. A new set of figures compiled in 1979 by the Texas Department of Water Resources was somewhat more optimistic. But the planning director of that same agency did not sound as if he subscribed to the optimism himself. "It's pretty easy to conjure up a disastrous series of events," said Herbert Grubb in 1980. "We're sort of assuming that a lot of the farmers will stay in business raising dryland cotton or wheat. But with interest rates high as they are, and dryland yields down 70 or 80% from irrigation yields, I really don't see how the farmers are going to carry their debts. The older ones, maybe. But the younger ones, the newer ones, are up to their ears in debt. So you could just as easily assume that millions of acres suddenly go fallow. Then along comes a drought, some 80-mile-an-hour winds, and you've got another dust bowl. The shelter belt trees are gone. A lot of those farmers are milking every cent out of the land while the water lasts. The conditions are ripe for something downright catastrophic." The decision of the Ogallala states to treat the aquifer as if it were a coal mine, thereby setting themselves up for a long, long fall, is ironic in an extreme sense. Their economies, as the states recognized and lamented long ago, are vulnerable to forces they can do little to control. What supports Colorado besides irrigated agriculture? Mainly minerals, coal, uranium, molybdenum, oil, and tourism, logging and ranching. Every one of those industries is subject to someone else's whim. World supply and demand, international cartels, the price of oil, the Federal Reserve Board, or the ultimate caprice of all, nature. Much the same applies to New Mexico. Oklahoma, Nebraska, and Kansas are farm states whose prosperity or ruin, before irrigation, depended on whether the isohyet of 20-inch rainfall moved westward down the Rockies or eastward toward the Mississippi River. Once they became dependent on a huge irrigation economy, all of the states knew they would be in the same position as a junkie. Texas, with its vanishing oil and gas, Kansas, astride the 100th meridian, Colorado, depending so much on tourists who, if oil prices doubled or there was no snow, would stay home. Each state knew that when the water ran out, they would again face the same awful vulnerability that had haunted them since the first settlers arrived. Strictly regulated, the Ogallala could have been made to last hundreds of years instead of decades. Irrigation farming could have been slowly phased in, kept at a lower level, and gradually phased out. In such a case, hundreds of thousands of people who became dependent on it overnight wouldn't face ruin, and the state's economies wouldn't go into sudden osmotic shock when the pumps began bringing up air. The states had begged the government to build them dams for irrigation, and they had lobbied to keep the price of water artificially low, arguing that agriculture was the only stability they had. The opportunity for economic stability offered by the world's largest aquifer, however, was squandered for immediate gain. The only inference one can draw is that the states felt confident that when they ran out of water, the rest of the country would be willing to rescue them. As Deputy Chief of Planning for the Bureau of Reclamation in the mid-1960s, Jim Casey saw things from a fundamentally different perspective than the farmers, or for that matter, most of his 11,000 colleagues. The main concern of the typical bureau engineer is building a bigger and grander project than the last one. It was Casey's job to think about what few of them did, or dared to. Reservoirs silting up, river basin funds drying up, salts building up. All the problems consigned through some unwritten conspiracy between politicians and bureaucrats to an amorphous, distant, and politically unrewarding future. Casey was, by definition, the Bureau's Cassandra. Peering into the future, he saw no place headed for deeper trouble than the Ogallala region. If surface water can be compared with interest income and non-renewable groundwater with capital, then much of the West was living mainly on interest income. California was milking interest and capital in about equal proportion. The Plain States, however, were devouring capital as a gang of spendthrift heirs might squander a great capitalist's fortune. To Casey's amazement, few of the farmers seemed to realize it. "They thought the water would last until the second coming," he says. Frustrated by the farmer's blindness, he finally decided that he had better address the one group that might listen to him, the region's bankers. "I think it was about 1966 when I went out to give my speech," Casey says. His voice, after 20 years in Washington, is still thickly gravied with West Texas drawl. "You wouldn't believe how many bankers there are in Lubbock. I said to them, 'Look, you're all riding high out here, and it's a great thing, and we all like to pretend that great things are going to last. But no aquifer can sustain this rate of pumping. I don't know when you're going to run out of water, but I'd bet you're going to run out about the same time you start running out of oil and gas. If that gets too expensive, the farmers won't be able to pump anyway. There goes your whole economy. This corner of the world is going to be an Appalachia without trees unless you get off your fannies and try to save it. I don't know if you can save it. I frankly don't know if it makes any sense for the nation to invest billions of dollars in a rescue project to keep a few million acres irrigated and a few hundred thousand people employed out here. I don't know where the water would come from, but you'd better start thinking about it now, because it will take 40 years to get a rescue project this big authorized and built, and you haven't got a lot of time left." The effect of Casey's speech was remarkable. "I gave them religion. A few months hadn't gone by before I heard they were setting up a big new lobby to fight for a rescue project. They called it Water Incorporated." Ambitious, perhaps even incredible as its goal was, a project to rescue even a modest portion of the irrigated plains would be a project more grandiose than any yet built. Water Incorporated had a number of things going for it. California's voters had just approved the most ambitious and expensive public works project ever attempted by a single state in order to save its own agricultural industry. Would Texans countenance that upstart state building something they lacked the nerve to attempt themselves? In the mid-1960s, the age of limits had not yet dawned. A High Plains rescue project was seen by many people as the next logical step in orderly water development, something that might even capture the fancy of the nation at large. The generation of politicians then running the country had been suckled and reared on public works. An astonishing number of them came from Texas. The President of the United States, for example. As Robert Caro demonstrated in the first volume of his biography of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, Johnson owed his political career largely to the Marshall Ford Dam. Begun under an emergency appropriation during the Depression, began, just like Grand Coulee and Garrison dams, before it was even authorized, and built on land the government didn't even own, the dam was to make a reputation and ultimately a huge fortune for a couple of struggling small-time contractors named Herman and George Brown. At the time, however, it was just a big Bureau of Reclamation dam on Texas's Colorado River, a few miles from Austin, a project which had run through its emergency appropriation before it was half built. To anyone else, this didn't matter much. No one doubted that the dam would be completed someday, but to the brothers Brown, it was a calamity. They had invested every nickel they owned and scraped together all the collateral they could in order to purchase $1.5 million worth of construction equipment they needed and didn't have. Until then, most of the Browns' contracts had been for road paving jobs. What they owned in construction equipment didn't amount to more than a few Fresno scrapers. If more funds were not approved immediately, they would go bankrupt. But everyone was crying for relief funds, and an unauthorized project with a serious land title problem in a remote corner of Texas was at a distinct disadvantage among its competition. In desperation, Herman Brown, the fiercely arch-conservative entrepreneur, pleaded for help from the district's most important politician, a newly elected 29-year-old liberal New Deal congressman whose name was Lyndon Baines Johnson. Using his connections among the White House inner circle and his absolutely shameless flattery of FDR, Johnson managed to get Herman and George Brown a formal authorization, a resolution of the land title dispute, and another $5 million to finish the dam as their lenders were about to smash down their barricaded door. Profoundly grateful, the brothers Brown poured enough money into Johnson's subsequent campaigns to catapult him into the Senate at a tender age. Their company, Brown & Root, was to grow into one of the largest construction firms in the world, mining the government just as Johnson mined the profits of their work, a symbiotic relationship that not only transcended ideology but subverted it, as public works are wont to do. And it all began with a dam. Johnson was not the only local politician who had climbed to political power up the wall of a dam. There was Robert Kerr of Oklahoma, one of the princes of the United States Senate until he died in 1963. Besides unabashedly using his Senate seat to make himself rich, he was a co-founder of the Kerr-McGee Corporation. Kerr helped authorize a number of very large reservoirs in his native state, which kept Oklahoma's construction industry perpetually busy, not only building new dams, but rerouting major highways around the ever-larger reservoirs that constantly formed in their path. Perusing a map of eastern Oklahoma, one would think that Kerr's ultimate goal was to put the state underwater. Then there was Jim Wright, who began representing Fort Worth in 1954 and was to become majority leader of the House in the late 1970s, a position he used to defy his own party's president in his attempt to knock off a few billion dollars' worth of water projects, including Wright's own favorite, the Trinity River Project, which was to turn Dallas and Fort Worth, sitting 400 miles from the ocean, into seaports. Wright's dedication to water projects struck some of his colleagues as fanatical. He took time out in the late 1960s to write a book called The Coming Water Famine, in which he said, "The crisis of our diminishing water resources is just as severe, if less obviously immediate, as any wartime crisis we have ever faced. Our survival is just as much at stake as it was at the time of Pearl Harbor, or the Argonne, or Gettysburg, or Saratoga. Pure water, when and where you need it, is worth whatever it costs to get it there." There was also Ray Roberts, who represented Sam Rayburn's old district and whose interest in water projects would elevate him to chairman of the House Public Works Committee. There was George Mahone, the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee in the 1960s and one of the five most powerful men in Congress who happened to represent the district around Lubbock. There was John Connolly, the governor of Texas, a Johnson protege whose enthusiasm for grandiose undertakings, big game hunting, and gigantic limousines made him into an unselfconscious parody of ambitious, super-affluent Texas. With such men in power during an era of no limits, anything seemed possible. Even a project to rescue the southern half of the Ogallala region by rerouting a substantial portion of the Mississippi River. The origins of the project went back to 1958, when a U.S. commission, chaired by George Brown of Brown & Root, was appointed to come up with a systematic plan for developing the river basins of the state. The proposal called for 83 storage reservoirs and some water conveyance works to be built by the year 2010, all of which, the commission modestly suggested, could be completed for around $4 billion. The great omission in the plan, however, was an aqueduct to West Texas. The reason for that appears self-evident. West Texas sits at an elevation more than 3,000 feet higher than East Texas, where most of the state's water is, and nearly 4,000 feet higher than Louisiana or Arkansas, the two states with enough of a water surplus to suggest themselves as the ultimate source. Pumping enough water to rescue several million acres that far uphill, over a distance of 1,000 miles or more, would require a fantastic amount of energy. The commission did not say this in those exact terms, but its omission of any proposal to rescue the Ogallala overdraft region spoke volumes. There followed, however, one of those peculiar metamorphoses in which a plan, as it evolves, conforms less and less to the constraints of nature, economics, and thermodynamics, and more to the stridency of certain constituents and the desires of certain elected officials. John Connolly saw in an Ogallala region rescue project an opportunity to become a pharaoh in a pinstripe suit. George Mahone, subjected to merciless lobbying by Water Incorporated, enjoyed the power of the purse by virtue of his being chairman of the Appropriations Committee. It was unthinkable that he would give East Texas and South Texas dozens of dams if West Texas got nothing in return. As a result, Connolly, as governor, pointedly disregarded the Browns Commission report and decided to draw up a proposal of his own. Its title was to be the Texas Water Plan. The idea was for several million acre-feet of water to be diverted from the Mississippi River below New Orleans, a point from where, presumably, Louisiana wouldn't mind its being taken, and moved across the marshlands and swamp forests of the state in an aqueduct built to the dimensions of an airplane hangar. A river approaching the Colorado in size, running in reverse, the water would climb up to Dallas and Fort Worth, which sit at an elevation of 750 feet, by way of a series of stair-step reservoirs. A generous portion would head toward those two cities in a spur aqueduct. Some of it would go to South Texas, but most of it would head toward Amarillo and Lubbock in the Trans-Texas Canal. There would be 17 pumping stations en route, lifting the water up the imperceptible slope of the plains. There would be 9 terminal reservoirs waiting to receive it. Nearly a million acre-feet a year would be fed into the Pecos River. Another 500,000 would head toward Corpus Christi. 6,480,000 acre-feet would arrive on the Texas High Plains, having climbed 3,600 feet and traveled 1,200 miles since New Orleans. 1.5 million acre-feet would perhaps go to New Mexico. 2 million acre-feet, the consumption of New York City and then some, would evaporate en route. It would take 6.9 million kilowatts of electricity to run it, about 40% of the electricity consumption of the entire state. As a politician from a neighboring state put it after hearing the plan, if those Texans can suck as hard as they can blow, they'll probably build it. Without knowing anything but the vaguest outlines of the plan, without knowing whether the farmers could afford the water, whether its acid character was compatible with the plains' alkaline soils, whether Texas water law didn't exempt the farms from paying a dime once the water had percolated to the aquifer, whether the power plants to move it could be financed and built, whether Louisiana had any intention of parting with one molecule of it, the voters of Texas suddenly found themselves, in August of 1969, being asked to appropriate $3.5 billion toward the Texas Water Plan's construction. Actually, the question was couched much more circumspectly than that. The proponents of the measure, which became known as Amendment 2, insisted that the voters were merely being asked to guarantee $3.5 billion in bonds to establish a repayable loan fund, which any city or region in the state could tap in order to meet its water needs, an argument which was greeted by the referendum's opponents with catcalls. The fact was, they said, that the Texas Water Development Board, which could arbitrarily and peremptorily decide who got how much of the money, was deeply committed to a rescue project for West Texas. Governor Preston Smith, who was trumping Amendment 2 up and down the state, was a native of West Texas. If the hidden agenda wasn't to build, or at least begin the rescue project, since the $3.5 billion would never complete a project of such magnitude, why had the referendum been scheduled for August in an off-year election when voter turnout was certain to be light and organized elements behind the measure could affect the outcome much more dramatically than during a regular election year? The one place where turnout was likely to be heavy was in West Texas, because the farmers would be at home busy with their crops, while a lot of East Texans would be off on vacation, escaping the humid heat. Why were the backers trying to distance themselves from the Texas Water Plan when that was the only plan that could absorb such a stupendous amount of money? This was, after all, 1969. In 1987, its equivalent would be more than $11 billion. "We were being sold a bill of goods," recalls Ronnie Duggar, the publisher of the Texas Observer, virtually the only newspaper in the state that opposed Amendment 2. It was actually $7 billion, not $3.5 billion, when you factored in the interest. $7 billion for what? No one was saying. No one knew. It was the biggest blank check in the history of the United States. All such objections notwithstanding, the proponents of the measure had managed to amass as formidable